everyone. So before I got started, are there any questions from yesterday? Okay, so I'm going to, before I get into talking about specific theories of new physics beyond the Standard Model, I want to talk a little bit about quantum field theory and try to give you a sense of how people think about quantum field theory when they're doing BSM physics. So I know, I guess you've all had a course in quantum field theory already. You've probably seen some more in the Standard Model course. So some of what I'm going to talk about today will be review. But at the same time, I hope to give you a slightly different perspective on things you've already seen and try to maybe help you build a bit of intuition. It sounds like you've done all the standard technical calculations and so on. I want to try to give you a slightly different perspective. So the first thing I want to talk about is dimensional analysis. And this is something that's really pretty trivial, but it's also really incredibly useful. So I'm sure you've all done dimensional analysis before. It's, in a sense, a fancy word for a well-educated guess. In terms of quantum field theory, though, as you know, some of the calculations involved are often fairly detailed and involved, and they take a while. And it's always a good idea to have an idea of what the answer ought to look like before you sit down and actually do the hard calculation. So this is where dimensional analysis comes in. So here is a sample Lagrangian. So I just have some scalar field, real scalar field phi, some Dirac fermion psi, and I'll give it a mass big M. And then I can write some interactions. So I can write a cubic self-coupling for the scalar. I can write a quartic self-coupling for the scalar. And I can write a Yukawa coupling that binds the scalar to the fermion. So again, nothing special here. I assume my notation is to everyone's satisfaction. This del mu squared is just shorthand for a to mu nu del mu phi del nu phi. So now I'm always going to use natural units. So I also assume you see natural units where we set h bar equal to c equals to 1. And for good measure, I'm also going to set the Boltzmann constant equal to 1. So if I start talking about temperatures will now also have dimension of energy or mass. So with these natural units, that means that a mass term dimensionally has mass dimension 1. So these square brackets mean the mass dimension of the quantity. And by definition, a mass has mass dimension 1. And similarly, in my natural units, this is the same as the dimensions of energy and momentum. So I set c equal to 1. The other thing is by setting c and h bar to 1, length has mass dimension minus 1, as does time. So again, nothing too shocking about this. Now, this is our Lagrangian. We're using this to define our theory. And the Lagrangian ultimately will go into an action. And the action, if I think about it in terms of path integral, gets exponentiated. So the action, by construction, has mass dimension 0. And you recall my action in d dimensions is just a ddx of the Lagrangian density. So I'll mostly work in four dimensions, but it doesn't hurt to think about other mass other space-time dimensions. So using this and using the fact that length has mass dimension of minus 1, I also have that derivatives, which of course is just d dx mu, has mass dimension of plus 1. Because the derivative of x is going to give me essentially a dimensionless quantity. So this is consistent with mass dimension plus 1. The other thing is integration measures, d dx is mass dimension minus d, because essentially I have d powers of the length unit, and each length unit has mass dimension minus one. So now I go back to my action, and my action is going to be this d d dx of L, and this implies the dimensionlessness of the action implies that the mass dimension of my Lagrangian has to be plus d in d dimensions. So now let's go back to our Lagrangian and sort out the mass dimensions of everything. So when dealing with Lagrangians for quantum field theories, you should always start with the kinetic terms. So the minimal thing you need to define a reasonable theory of a propagating particle using quantum fields are the kinetic terms. So you always start there. So if you look at the del phi squared term, the del phi squared term being part of the action has to have mass dimension d. Sorry, being part of the Lagrangian density has mass dimension plus d. And this thing has the form of a derivative acting on phi squared. So this thing is going to have a plus 2 from the two derivatives plus 2 times the mass dimension of phi. And I can go and solve this. And this just tells me that the mass dimension of phi in d dimensions is d minus 2 over 2. Or if I specialize to 4 dimensions, it's just mass dimension 1. If I do the same exercise for the fermion kinetic term, which has the form phi bar psi bar down mu psi, the gamma matrix is just some dimensionless thing. Again, this is d. And this goes on to tell me that my fermion mass dimension is going to be d minus 1 over 2. Or I can rewrite this in a suggestive way as 3 halves plus d minus 4 over 2. And I could have done the same thing for phi. I could have written this as 1 plus d minus 4 over 2. OK, in any case, I see that my scalar in 4 dimensions has mass dimension 1. And my fermion in 4 dimensions has mass dimension 3 halves. Now, if you go back and look at the other terms of the Lagrangian, suppose I look at the mass term. If I do the same thing for the mass term, m squared phi squared, again, this is d. And this is going to be equal to 2 times the mass dimension of the mass term plus 2 phi. And now if I plug this back in any number of dimensions, that this means that my mass term m has mass dimensions d, sorry, mass dimension 1, as it should. And in the same way, you can show that the fermion mass dimension is also 1. So we call these mass terms, and we interpret them as masses. And fortunately, they have the right structure such that they always have a mass dimension of 1. And another way to see it is m squared phi squared is essentially the same structure as del phi squared. And each derivative always has mass dimension plus 1. And the mass is coming in roughly in the same way in terms of a dimensional analysis. So this is easy. We also have the interaction terms. So I got my a phi cubed. And for now, I'll just do this in 4 dimensions. You can generalize it to any number. And this thing is going to be mass dimension of a plus 3 times mass dimension of phi, which means that my mass dimension of a is plus 1. So this coupling constant a is a dimensionful quantity with mass dimension plus 1. I do the same thing for lambda phi to the fourth. Again, this is 4 is equal to lambda plus 4 phi, which means that my lambda now has mass dimension 0. It's a dimensionless quantity. And I do the same thing with psi bar psi phi y. And I get that this Yukawa coupling is also dimensionless in four dimensions. So in principle, I could have also written higher order terms. So for example, I could have written a term in the Lagrangian of the form phi to the sixth. And the phi to the sixth would have come in with some prefactor. Let's say I call it zeta. And in four dimensions, if I look at the mass dimension of this quantity, this is going to be 4. And this is going to be equal to the mass dimension of zeta plus 6 phi, which implies that in four dimensions, the zeta quantity has mass dimension of minus 2. So for now, let's just stick with these terms up top. The defining structure of these terms is that this is the most general set of terms, with a few assumptions, but this is essentially the most general set of terms where I only have dimensionless or positive dimension couplings. I'll come back to talk about how to deal with couplings of negative mass dimension down the road. But the upshot of this, and you may have seen this in your QFT course, is that roughly speaking, as long as my Lagrangian only has couplings of a zero or positive mass dimension, my theory is going to be renormalizable. If I start to have couplings with negative mass dimension, I lose renormalizability, typically, and I'm going to have to work a little bit harder. Okay, so far I've just pulled out stuff in the Lagrangian, but this kind of picture is also useful for estimating things like cross-sections and decay rates. So where shall I start? So one example, suppose I have a heavy scalar and lighter fermions. So if I have a heavy scalar and lighter fermions, so let's say M is much, much bigger than M, what I can have is my scalar decaying into psi bar through the Yukawa coupling. So this is going to look like, in terms of a leading order Feynman diagram, a phi going to psi bar. And OK, this is straightforward to calculate and so on and so forth. But without calculating anything, we can make an estimate for it in a limit where little m is much bigger than big M, just based on dimensional analysis. So first of all, the thing we want to compute is the decay rate. And decay rates have mass dimension of plus 1. So it's a rate, so it goes like 1 over time, so it has positive mass dimension. So my decay rate, I'll just put a squiggle on it, because I'm just doing an estimate here. The squiggle means an estimate. This interaction, this process, is going to go through y. So it goes through the y coupling. And I would get at least one power of y in the amplitude. But I know that to get the matrix element that goes into the scattering width, I square this. So that means I need at least two powers of y in the numerator of my expression. In principle, I can have more, but I need at least two. The other thing is that this is going to have positive mass dimension. And if you think about the typical energies and momenta of the particles in the system, in the limit where this little m is much bigger than big M, the mass of the incoming guy is obviously little m. And the momenta and energies of these fermions coming out are also going to be on the order of m. So as far as this process goes, in this limit, the only relevant dimensionful quantity is this m. So that means that dimensionally, it should depend on just y squared and m. And this is my dimensional analysis estimate for the k width. If you actually sit down and compute it, you get essentially this with some corrections that go like factors of little m over big m. So I haven't done any serious calculation, but this turns out to be a pretty good approximation to the k width. So again, this is very trivial, but it turns out to be very useful. as a second application, suppose I look at phi goes to phi phi, so just elastic scattering of the phi particle. And suppose I also look at this specifically in the limit of y goes to 0, a goes to 0, and I also look at it at very high energy. So by very, very high energy, I mean that EP much, much greater than the mass of these phi particles. So I sit down, I compute my cross-section, and my cross-section should, my cross-section for this process, I know in this limit, is going to be dominated by the lambda coupling. So this will be the leading order Feynman diagram. So this cross-section should go like lambda. But cross-sections have dimensions of area. So area is like length squared, which means mass dimension of minus 2. And that means that I need two powers of some dimensionful quantity in the denominator. So in this case, if I look at it in the very high energy limit, the energies of momentum much, much bigger than m. The only relevant quantity is the energy of the momentum. They're essentially interchangeable in this case. And the cross-section should go like lambda over e squared. If I want to be slightly fancier, I can rewrite e squared. Instead of expressing it this way, I can rewrite it in terms of s, where s is a Mandelstam variable, which is p1 plus p2 squared, where p1 and p2 are the initial momenta, and p3 and p4 are the outgoing momenta. So have you seen Mandelstam variables? S, t, and u? Yeah. OK. So equivalently, I could have written this as lambda over s. So the energy and s in this limit are essentially interchangeable as well. So again, I have some estimate for the cross-section. And if you were to go and sit down and actually calculate this and work it out properly, you'd find that you get something that reduces to this, maybe with a few extra powers of 4 pi and some factors of 2. But morally, this is the size of the answer. So far, these first two examples have been fairly trivial. Suppose we instead look at a slightly different limit of couplings. Suppose you look at phi phi goes to phi phi, and the limit of very small lambda, very small y, but where now we still have this a coupling. And the a coupling can contribute to phi phi to phi phi through diagrams that look like this, and so on and so forth. So now if I estimate the cross-section that's dominated by the a coupling, my cross-section now, I have to have at least two powers of a in the amplitude. So that means that this cross-section has to go like at least a to the fourth. But now the total cross-section has to have mass dimensions of minus 2. And that means that I need, in this case, three powers of the Mandelstam variable s. So remember, s has mass dimensions. So this is like e to the sixth. So what I get out of this story, just based on dimensional analysis, because this coupling has a positive mass dimension, and because we need at least two powers of it in the amplitude, it tells me that the energy dependence of this cross-section in the high energy limit is different from the high energy limit of the cross-section through the lambda coupling. So again, without actually doing any calculation, I can say that in the high energy limit for a and in lambda of similar order, this cross-section will be more important than this one. On the other hand, going to low energies, this contribution ends up being more important than the other one. One other comment about the a coupling. One way to see that you need at least two powers in the amplitude without drawing Feynman diagrams is noticing that as a goes to 0, you have a symmetry under phi goes to minus phi. So sorry, if I set y to 0 and lambda to 0, or I don't set lambda to 0, if I set y to 0 and a to 0, I have a symmetry under phi to minus phi. I can restore that symmetry if I also pretend that a transforms, a goes to minus a. But the amplitude should be symmetric under that. And that, again, tells me that I need two powers of a. OK. In any case, I'll talk more about this in a second. But this dimensional analysis technique, I strongly recommend before you do any serious calculation, always to do a dimensional analysis estimate of the size of the effect you're going to calculate in your quantum field theory. The next thing I want to talk about is renormalization. And to talk about renormalization, I'm going to focus on a slightly simpler theory. I'm going to focus just on the even part on just the even part of the scalar sector of the theory. So again, you probably already renormalized this. I want to go over this in a slightly different way. It should be a slightly different way from what you've seen. And I want to connect it with the dimensional analysis argument. So in terms of this basic Lagrangian, I derive a propagator of p squared minus m0 squared plus I epsilon. And I would derive a vertex of minus I lambda 0 for a four-point vertex. Just the usual story. And the basic objects we want to compute in this theory are our endpoint functions. And I'm going to focus on a certain kind of endpoint function, which are connected and one particle irreducible. So what I mean by connected is that all the parts of the Feynman diagram should be connected into a single piece. So for example, if I was to compute a four-point function, one potential contribution to a four-point function would look like this. But this is obviously just two-point functions brought together. So I'm going to ignore those and just look at four-point functions of the form where all the pieces of the diagram are connected with each other. So this is what I mean by connected. So this is a connected four-point function. And this is not connected. Okay, so actually, this line isn't part of the Feynman diagram. It's just me crossing out in anger. So the first thing is I'm going to focus on endpoint functions that are connected. The second thing I'm going to concentrate on are endpoint functions that have a property called one particle irreducibility. So again, if I think about a four-point function, this would be a tree-level piece. But if I go beyond tree-level, I could have higher-order corrections. So a particular higher order correction would be that. And then I could also draw it with the full legs and so on. But another kind of higher order correction would be just essentially the same old vertex, but where I decorate one of the external legs. And this, compared to this correction, is in a sense less interesting in that this is essentially a correction to the two-point function that I've tacked onto the four-point function. Whereas this is a genuine correction to the four-point function that doesn't come up, let's say, in a two-point function. So this diagram has the property being called one particle irreducible. And this diagram has the property of being one particle irreducible. This one doesn't. And what I mean specifically by being one PI, or one particle irreducible, is that if I have a diagram where I can take a single leg on the diagram and make a cut on it such that that cut gives me an independent two-point diagram, that diagram isn't one particle irreducible. So I'm going to calculate specifically what I call gamma n. And this is the endpoint connected 1PI function for the quantum field theory. Because as long as I have these endpoint 1PI functions, I can put them together to make the general, let's say, connected, in this case, four-point function. This would be a 1PI two-point diagram that I add on to a four-point diagram, for example. So I can build up any endpoint function I want by looking at these basis endpoint functions. Yeah? Okay, so this is for a four-point function. One example for a two-point function. So as far as a two-point function goes, this is still 1PI because there's no kind of external piece that I can cut to give an independent part that isn't just a tree-level propagator. But an example on a two-point function, it's not 1PI. Is that in that I can cut here. And in this case, I have, so in this case, if I cut an external leg, boy, the rule is you're not allowed to cut on tree level propagators. You're not allowed to cut external tree level propagators, but you are allowed to cut in between non-trivial diagrams of this sort. And the whole point is that this is just an iteration of that on the two-point function leg. So if I cut here, I just get I get a two-point function back plus an extra two-point function. And the same thing goes here. If I cut here, I get back a four-point function, which is what I was computing in the first place, plus an extra two-point function. So in general, if I look at an endpoint function, if I cut a single propagator and it gives me back an endpoint function plus an extra two-point function, that diagram is not 1 PI. It's kind of hard to define, but it's easy to see in practice. So essentially, you don't want extra bubbles on legs. Very good. So I'm going to compute these endpoint functions. And I'm going to compute them in a sense that I'm also going to drop all the external propagators. So for example, for the contribution to gamma 4, this would just give me minus I lambda. And this thing would give me essentially this loop plus minus I lambda minus I lambda. And I'm just going to not write the external propagators on these gamma n's. I'm going to take that as part of the definition of the gamma n. So again, the external leg propagators are just things I tack on. And by looking at this, I focus on the key part, the key irreducible part of the diagram that I care about. OK. So now let's take this theory, and let's think about these gamma n's, or specifically the quantum corrections to the gamma n's. I know that tree level, I only have gamma 2 and gamma 4. And the gamma 2 is just the propagator. The gamma 4 at tree level is just the four-point vertex. So let's look at loop corrections. And let's start off by looking at the form of the one loop correction to the 2n point piece. So I'll write it this way. So for example, for n equals 1, this would be a correction like this. So this is n equals 1. For n equals 2, I would have a correction that looks like that. For n equals 3, it would be a correction to the 6-point function. And so on and so forth. And you can see that as I keep on going higher and higher in n, I just tack on an extra one of these kind of v's onto the central loop. And if you think about evaluating these, I'm going to have at each power of at each value of n, I'm going to have n powers of the vertex. So this thing is going to go roughly like lambda 0 to the n. I have n powers of the vertex at nth order. And I'm going to have an integration over the internal loop momentum. And then I'm going to have some set of propagators. And this set of propagators, for n equals 1, I have one propagator. N equals 2, I have 2. N equals 3 equals 3, and so on and so forth. And this means that I get q squared minus m0 squared plus I epsilon to the n at nth loop order. So the standard thing to do to evaluate these loop integrals is to transform to Euclidean space. So you do a Wick rotation. You transform to Euclidean space, in which case this thing becomes essentially a Euclidean integral. A second. And this denominator becomes positive definite. Sorry, Antiba?
So delta at lambda is defined as the one-loop correction?
In general, it'll be all the corrections, but for now, I'm just doing the one-loop piece. So this is the leading correction to the endpoint function. In principle, I could do more, but for now, I'm just going to do this. So if I take this, I transform to Euclidean space, and think about the high energy limit. The high energy limit of this looks like lambda 0 at the n, and I'm going to get some number times an integral of dqe times 1 over qe squared plus m squared to the nth power. Oh, and sorry. And then because it's a d4, I also get 3 powers of qe here. And this goes from 0 to infinity. So all I've done here is the usual wick rotation trick. I've turned my d4q, I've written it as an angular part times a radial part. The radial part in 4 dimensions gives me a q squared dq from 0 to infinity. The radial part, the angular part, I've just tossed into this number here. And this is the remnant Euclidean denominator. So now, if I think about the structure of this, it's well behaved as QE goes to 0. But funny stuff starts to happen as I go to very large momenta. And in particular, unless n is sufficiently large, this is formally divergent. And divergences aren't very nice. So instead of worrying about divergences, I'm going to replace infinity by something large here. And I'll come back and set this large to infinity later on. So what I'm doing is instead of doing the full integration up to infinitely large momenta, I'm cutting off that momentum integration by hand in Euclidean space. And I'm going to come back and take the limit as this goes to infinity later on. So the structure of this, at the end of the day, is going to be some number times lambda 0 to the n times, it can have finite parts, but also have parts that depend on lambda. And the parts that depend on lambda have the following form. Lambda to the 4 minus 2n. So for example, if n was equal to 1, for n equals to 1, I have dq to qe to the 4th over qe squared. So this thing diverges quadratically for n equals to 1. For n equals to 0, this thing goes like dq qe cubed over qe to the 4th, which means that for n equals 2, this diverges logarithmically. So let me give a couple of explicit examples. For n equals 1, at large momentum, this thing goes like integral to lambda dqe qe cubed over qe to the 4th for the large momentum part of this. Qe squared, which formally goes like linear in the integrand, which means that this goes like lambda squared. For n equals 2, this thing goes like blah to infinity, dqe, 1 over qe, which goes like a log lambda. But for all larger n, for n greater than or equal to 3, the integration is finite in the ultraviolet. So what we see from this is that at this level, the one-point corrections to the endpoint functions, the divergence structure in the ultraviolet cuts off. So if I go to a certain level, above this level, this stuff is all UV convergent, whereas this stuff has UV divergences. One other comment is here, when I say lambda, for n equals 2, I'd have 4 minus 4 equals 0. Formally, this limit of lambda to the 0 really means log lambda, because that's what we find in practice. So sometimes when I write these general formulas, if you have some power to the zeroth order, you should interpret that as a log divergence. Okay, so again, I've just told you stuff that you've probably already seen. There are divergences in this theory. If I do the most simple-minded way of dealing with the divergences by just, instead of integrating to infinite Euclidean momentum, I cut it off at some finite value, I see that the two-point function has a quadratic divergence, and the four-point function has a log divergence, and all the higher endpoint functions at one loop are convergent in the UV. Okay, so the question now is what should I think of these would-be divergences? Because when we started off in our theory, we were all happy and gung-ho, and I'm going to go integrate over everything I can possibly integrate, and I run into this problem where when I integrate over everything I can possibly integrate, the wheels fall off my car, I find these divergences, what do I do? The thing that's going wrong here, though, is that I've been a bit too enthusiastic. So the place where these divergences are coming from is obviously I'm summing over these internal loop momenta. And by summing over the internal loop momenta, what I'm saying is that here's a quantum mechanical quantity, and I'm computing a quantum mechanical amplitude. And when you compute a quantum mechanical amplitude, you compute you compute up all the contributions to the amplitude, all the possible different ways that the thing can happen quantum mechanically. You sum over all the possibilities, and that goes into your amplitude. Here, my sum over possibilities includes a sum over all possible internal loop momenta. And I've implicitly assumed that that set of full possibilities includes integrations up to infinitely large loop momenta. And what I find is, if I make that assumption that I can sum over infinitely large loop momenta, I get these divergences, and that's not good. Where renormalization comes in is what we've done already is we've taken these would-be infinite things, we've regularized them. In the sense of these formally infinite things, we've made them finite by hand. We've put in some way to at least control the divergences. What we want to do is renormalize these. And there's a physical basis for renormalization. And the physical basis for renormalization is that the fact that this is diverging is just telling us that we shouldn't necessarily trust our theory to infinitely high energies. Instead, let's be a little bit less ambitious. Instead of saying that our theory works up to arbitrarily high energies, let's just say that, okay, we have these divergences, this isn't so good. Let's just assume that our theory is good up to some finitely large energy, let's say defined in a Euclidean sense. And let's make the wild assumption that at some relatively large energy or momentum scale, that's large at least relative to all the dimensional quantities of the theory, that something fancy happens, some new physics comes in, and tames these divergences. So let's assume that something comes in, fixes these divergences, and makes everything finite. This is nice, because now we don't have to worry about divergences. But it's also not so nice because we don't know what that new thing coming in, we don't know what that new saving theory comes in. We don't know how it comes in, we don't necessarily know what it does. But it turns out that we can essentially parameterize the effects of this new thing coming in and making the theory finite in terms of the parameters of the Lagrangian. And this is what it's going to mean to have a normalizable theory. That all these effects of things that are coming in and getting rid of these would-be divergences can be folded in to the low energy effective parameters of the theory in a suitable way. And this folding in process is what we call renormalization. And a renormalizable theory is just one where only a finite number of low energy parameters have to be fixed in some suitable way. So let me illustrate this with renormalized perturbation theory. Again, I assume you've seen this, but it doesn't hurt to go over it a second time. Thank you. Okay, so to renormalize this theory, look at the theory I have on the right upper left. Let's rewrite our field the following way. Let's rewrite our field in terms of some new rescaled field, and plug this back in to my Lagrangian. And if I plug this back into my Lagrangian that I have up there, I just get z del phi tilde squared minus 1/2 m0 squared z phi tilde squared minus lambda 0 over 4 factorial z squared phi tilde the fourth. And I can rewrite this in the following suggestive way. Oh, this should be 1/2. I can rewrite this as 1/2 del phi squared minus 1/2 m squared phi tilde squared. OK, so I want to point out two things about this rewriting. I've taken exactly the same Lagrangian I had before, and I've just rewritten it in terms of a slightly different variable and in terms of slightly different parameters. So notice that I started off with m0 squared and lambda 0. What I have here doesn't have a 0. What I have here is an m squared and a lambda without that little 0 subscript. And what I've done is rewritten this piece in terms of things that, in a sense, look nice, plus extra corrections. And these extra corrections are what we call counterterms. And what's going to happen, the way we're going to renormalize the theory, is we're going to go off, we're going to compute in the same way as before, and we're going to use the counterterms as corrections to what we compute with this piece. So formally, when I compute to some order with this, the counterterms come in at one higher order in the perturbative expansion. And whenever I have divergent pieces involving these parameters, I'm going to cancel them off with the counterterms. So the idea is this rewriting is rewriting the theory in terms of things that, at the end of the day, I'm going to try to maintain as finite, and I'm going to eventually relate them to physical observables. And this extra piece, these counterterms, you can think of as the stuff coming in from this magical unspecified high energy theory that makes all my divergences not divergent, that actually makes everything finite. So let's see how this works in practice. I should also say that you can compute del lambda and del m squared in terms of these parameters. So for example, my del z is just z minus 1. My del lambda is just z squared lambda naught minus lambda, and so forth. So this is just a suggestive rewriting of the original theory, but it also happens to be very handy. And it's handy in that now I'm going to formulate the theory in terms of this is my tree level piece and this as corrections. So my Feynman rules in this updated theory, they're equivalent to the original ones, but they're just recast in a different way. My propagator now is going to be an I over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And now I have an m squared instead of an m0 squared. My four-point function is going to be minus I lambda. Now it's lambda, not lambda 0. But on top of this, I'm also going to have corrections. And I'm going to have corrections from the counterterms. The first two counterterms I can think of as corrections of the form minus I p squared del z. Minus p squared plus del m squared. So I have this propagator, but I also have this two-point correction. And I also have a 4-point correction, which is minus I del lambda. So in this recasting of our original theory, this is called renormalized perturbation theory, what we're going to do is compute with these things. And then when these things have loops, we're going to cancel them off with these counter terms added as corrections. So let me give you an explicit example. Figure out my blackboard technique. Okay, I think that's mostly visible. Okay, so let's go back and compute our correction to the two-point function, but let's be a little bit more careful about it. So my delta lambda 2, assuming I have an external momentum of a p squared going around, this is going to be a 1pi correction to the two-point function, and it's going to have this general form. And this thing, at leading order, well, there's a tree-level piece, and I want the one-loop part. The one-loop part is going to have the same form as before. So at one loop, I just have this bubble. But I also have an extra contribution from the counter terms, which I'm going to write as that. And if I take the sum of these, what I find is I'm going to get something that goes like lambda times an integral times 1 over qe squared plus m squared. So I've already Euclideanized. And then my counter term contribution is going to be a p squared del z plus del m squared. So I've done a bunch of steps at once. I've implicitly put in this regulator. I've put in the counter terms, and I've Euclideanized here. And if I go and I compute this integral, what I find is that it has the following form. Okay, so if I go off and I compute this integral, I put in the counter terms, I find that there's a correction. Well, actually, in principle, I can have a correction that goes like the external momentum p squared. In this particular case, it turns out that this is actually there's actually no dependence for this particular diagram on the external momentum. So in this particular case, it just turns out that a1 and a2 are both 0. So I can choose my del z to be 0. But more generally, I'll have non-zero contributions to things like a1 and a2, corresponding to this p squared correction to the two-point function. But I can also have corrections to parts that aren't proportional to p squared. And these corrections have, first of all, there's a quadratic divergence. This matches up with what we found before for n equals 1. There's a quadratic divergence. But even beyond the quadratic divergence, there can also be a log divergence multiplying the mass squared, m squared. So this is, if you like, a subleading divergence. It's not as divergent as this, but still divergent formally. And then I can have a finite piece that goes like m squared. The other thing is, if you think about dimensional analysis, what I'm computing here is a two-point function. And the two-point function should have mass dimension 2, at least once I get rid of the propagators. And you can check that this and this both have mass dimension 2. And the only things in my theory with mass dimension that that could possibly come in are p squared, or m squared, or lambda squared. These are the three-dimensional quantities. So just based on dimensional analysis, everything has the right form as well. Again, it's always a good cross-check. In any case, we have this. And I can do something similar for the four-point function. For the four-point function, I'm running out of board space, but the four-point function I can do more efficiently. The four-point function is going to have corrections for diagrams like this. There are actually three. There's an ST and U diagram, but they all have this form. And then there's also the counter term diagram. And this four-point function, I should probably just, I'm going to rewrite this on the other board. This four-point function has the form delta lambda 4. And it can depend on the external momenta in the form of ST and U. And this thing is going to go like lambda d4 qe over 2 pi to the fourth. It's going to have something that goes roughly like qe squared plus m squared squared. There will also be some other contributions from the external momenta. But for now, let's just set those to 0. It has this form. And then I also have this counter term, del lambda. And if I look at the form of this roughly has the form of lambda squared of c1 times some log of lambda squared over some function of s, t, and u, the external momenta, plus a possible constant c2, plus del lambda. So this is my four-point correction. And I can also look at the one-loop corrections to all the higher-order diagrams. But all the higher-order diagrams, we just argued, are finite. So I don't have to worry about those as long as I concentrate specifically on all the one-point diagrams. And for example, one of the reasons why I only worry about one PI diagrams is that, for example, I could look at a six-point function. There is a divergent contribution of the six-point function at two loops. But it's easy to see that this divergence is essentially a two-point function divergence tacked onto the six-point function. So going back, the reason why we're looking at 1PI stuff is it lets us focus on the important parts. So the next stage is we want to renormalize the theory. And to renormalize the theory, what we're going to do is say that theory should reproduce certain observables at certain kinematic endpoints. So the first one is, let's look at the mass of the particle. So the mass of the particle, if you recall, the physical mass of a particle corresponds to the real part of the pole of the propagator, including all the corrections. So our propagator, our full quantum corrector propagator, if we include these corrections of the two-point function and we sum them, it's going to have the form of I over p squared minus m squared minus delta lambda 2 of p squared. So actually, just in passing, is this something you've seen in your quantum field theory course? So essentially, I've computed a two-point function. And what I'm doing here is my propagator, if I resum all the external pieces, I have the tree-level piece, plus I have the one-loop piece, plus and then on and on and on. And I can write this as I over p squared minus m squared plus I over p squared minus m squared times delta lambda 2 over p squared minus m squared. And then the next thing just gives me this thing with this squared and so on. And I just resum the geometric series. And I get an I over p squared minus m squared times 1 over 1 minus delta lambda 2 over p squared minus m squared, summing this geometric series. And when I multiply this through, I just get my I over p squared minus m squared minus delta lambda 2, which is what I have here. So my quantum corrected propagator is a tree-level piece with this with this two-point function correction. And what we want to get out of our propagator is that, first of all, the pole of the propagator, when p squared is equal to the physical mass, if I set p squared equals to the physical mass, this propagator should have a pole at that point. So in other words, the pole of propagator at the physical mass, or sorry, the physical mass at the pole of the propagator. And on top of that, when we're sitting at the pole of the propagator, we want the residue of the pole to be equal to 1. So in other words, this propagator is, by assumption, has the form of p squared minus m phi squared when p squared goes to the physical mass, m phi squared, that we observe experimentally. Yes?
Or over there, it would seem like it would need to work at all orders in perturbation theory. Like, I guess you could imagine doing loop diagrams of your counter terms and things like that. Or having one particle irreducible diagrams that are more than one loop. Like, does the cancellation happen? Like, is there an easy way to see that the cancellation would happen at all orders?
So for now, I'll just do one loop, and then I'll come back and wave my hands about multiple loops later on. But yeah, so what you would do at higher loop order is you'd have more complicated divergence structures, but the claim is you can still use the same counter terms to cancel off those divergences. So I'll come back to that. So for now, let's just worry about one loop, and then worry about higher loops later on. Okay, so our propagator should have the form of I over p squared minus m squared as p squared goes to the physical mass. So there are two parts to this. The first is saying that as p squared goes to the physical mass, it has a pole. And the second part is the residue of that pole is equal to 1. So we can apply this to our quantum corrected propagator here. And this gives us two renormalization conditions. So the first condition is that the first condition, and this is only a choice, but the first condition is let's choose to define m squared equals m phi squared. So at this point in our Lagrangian, we didn't actually say what m squared was. We've done this, if you like, arbitrary splitting of the Lagrangian into tree-level pieces plus counter terms. The renormalization step is we now try to relate the stuff in the non-counter term part of the Lagrangian to physical observables. So for connecting the m squared part to a physical observable, a natural choice is to set m squared in our Lagrangian equal to the physical mass squared of the particle. So that's our first choice. And the second choice has to do with wanting the residue of the pole to be equal to 1. And for the residue of the pole to be equal to 1, or sorry, before I get to that, this is equivalent to saying that lambda 2 at p squared equals m squared is equal to 0. So if this thing vanishes as p squared goes to m squared, I get a pole as p squared goes to m squared, and that identifies m squared with the physical mass. So that's my first renormalization condition. My second renormalization condition is I choose my residue equal to 1. This is mostly just a normalization convention, not necessarily physical, but this corresponds in this limit, if you think about expanding this out around the pole for p squared close to m squared, this corresponds to d2 dp squared at p squared equals m squared equals to 0. So the first condition is setting delta lambda 2 equal to 0 as p squared goes to m squared just identifies m squared with the physical mass. Sorry about the lectern. I'd raise it, but I can't. I'll write it over here. The second condition is d delta lambda 2 dp squared p squared equals m squared is equal to 0. So I have these two renormalization conditions. And I can satisfy these two renormalization conditions automatically, in the sense that in the sense that I have two counterterms and two conditions, and these two conditions and these two counterterms can be used to fix del z and del m squared at this one loop order. So I take those two conditions and those two counterterms, and that lets me specify, first of all, what these counterterms are in terms of things that depend on lambda. But it also lets me specify what these things in my non-counterterm Lagrangian are in terms of physical observables. And there's one third counter, there's one third counterterm condition. I have a third counterterm, which is del lambda. And a nice choice for that is a nice choice for that is just delta 4 for s equals 4m squared, t equals u equals to 0 is equal to 0. And again, I can satisfy this by an appropriate choice of del lambda. And the physical significance of this choice is that if I think about my scattering amplitude, my scattering amplitude is going to be, my scattering amplitude for four-point scattering is going to be minus I lambda minus I delta lambda 4 at the corresponding st and u point. And this choice of setting it equals to 0 is just saying that my scattering, my phi to phi elastic scattering, is just given by the tree level expression exactly at this particular momentum point. At different momentum points, I'm still going to have an extra correction to it. But at this particular momentum point, s equals 4m squared, which corresponds to threshold scattering, where the two particles are essentially at rest, the total amplitude is just a tree level expression. So what I've just done now is renormalize the theory. Again, you've probably seen this in your QFT course. But what I've traded in is my original Lagrangian, which, oh, it's still there, very good, in terms of these m0 and lambda 0 parameters. I've re-expressed this original Lagrangian, which we found has formal divergences, in terms of a quantity of a recast Lagrangian based on these renormalized parameters plus counterterms. And now all of the dependence on all the dependence on the cutoff is lumped into these counterterms. Whereas the rest of the theory, this m squared lambda, is written in terms of observables. And the magic of this, and I haven't gotten to this, but the real magic of renormalization is now, and this is the bigger claim is now if I take this theory with these fixed counterterms, I fix the counterterms with these renormalization conditions, and these, if you like, physical couplings on the first line, if I go off and I compute any other process in this theory whatsoever, any divergences, any would-be divergences in that theory will be completely canceled off by these counterterms, even at different momentum points. So what we get out of the theory is we've needed two experimental inputs, the physical mass of the particle and, let's say, a cross-section at a certain momentum point. But we can now go off and make predictions for all kinds of other observables in the theory without any obvious divergences, because any apparent divergences would be canceled off by the counterterms, and we don't have to vary those anymore. So what we get is we get a theory that can make predictions, but it's always making predictions of one set of observables in terms of a set of basis of observables. In this case, this theory is said to be renormalizable in the sense that we only need a finite set of counterterms, and corresponding to that, we only need a finite set of renormalization conditions. But once we fix those renormalization conditions with an appropriate set of physical observables, everything else in the theory that we calculate and predict is formally finite and gives a prediction of the theory. So if you like, we've had to lower our standards a little bit compared to what we had initially hoped. Initially, you might have hoped that you could take the Lagrangian, specify what m0 is, and specify what lambda 0 is, and go off and calculate whatever you like. That's just not possible because of these apparent divergences. But what we can do is something that is slightly less good, but still entirely predictive, in that we take, instead of being able to predict things directly from our theory, we're able to use our theory to predict one set of observables in terms of a set of basis observables. And this is what you get out of a renormalizable theory. The renormalizable theory needs a finite set of counterterms, and it lets you fix a finite set of measurements and make an infinite set of predictions from that. So we still have theoretical predictivity. We just also need to rely on experiment to fix some of the stuff in our setup. So most of what I cover today should be, I assume it's review. I'm going to extend this a little bit to non-renormalizable theories and effective field theories tomorrow. So again, please let me know if you have any questions. I realized I've probably been fairly sketchy about this, but hopefully you've seen the actual detailed calculations that go into it. Yes?
So, I mean, in a classical theory, we still have to measure the observables, right? So here, I mean, why is it less?
Suppose I took classical electromagnetism. If I said that, if I wrote down a theory that was classical electromagnetism, but I said that the electric charge was whatever, and I could go off and make unambiguous predictions in terms of that theory with my specified charge, and there wouldn't be any ambiguity, and that theory might not be the theory of electromagnetism we see. I mean, the value of the charge I wrote down might not be the actual measure value of the charge, but I would still be able to make predictions directly from that theory I wrote down. In this case, if I just write down this theory and I say M0 is 1 GeV and lambda 0 is 0.5, I can't. That doesn't help me. I really need these extra observables on top of that. So it's a slight step down from what I would have had in a theory that was completely finite, but it's still pretty good. Okay, cool. I'll wrap it there.